Okay, so what's this notion of flow? This is the only other person that Martin Seligman acknowledges has anything important to say about positive psychology. He's Hungarian by birth, and his basic, from a positive psychology point of view, his basic research question was not asking when are people unhappiest, what's wrong with them, all the rest, but when are people experiencing most happiness or satisfaction with life, and what characterizes those episodes. And he used two methods, both of which converged. When I say random time sampling, I mean he got beepers to go off at random moments in people's lives and had got them to agree that when they went off, they'd give a quick account of what they were doing and how much they valued what they were doing at the time. And the other would be to pick people, and I think his first sample was New York sculptors, and interviewed them at length about the subjective nature of the experience when they were really caught up in their work. So this is a positive psychologist going straight for the big question, you know, what's the best experience we can have and what seems to characterize it? And he called this flow, which was a term that came up in interviews rather than being his original choice. That's one publication. His name's pronounced Csikszentmihalyi, or at least that's the best my English voice will do on the Hungarian name. You'll probably, on the slides, I'll refer to him by his initials. So the notion of flow is an attempt to describe the mental state that humans most value, I think is best. And generally speaking, it's characterized by being fully absorbed in what you're doing. We're going to come to a number of ifs and buts, but that's probably the best one or two line introduction. Autotelic experience, that's Csikszentmihalyi's using a technical term, which I believe he uses to indicate not just that it's most enjoyable, but that it's most valued in that participant's own personal life values. So there are a number of subjective phenomena that tend to go with it, being completely focused at the bottom, losses are coming at one, winning it for the day, losing all track of time, feeling of control. I wonder if his subjects say that. I suppose my take on people, that is what I feel myself, is that we're all natural-born dictators, and we think there's absolutely nothing wrong with being in total control. We're just more and more depressed and irritated when we don't have total control. And that explains a lot of things. It explains why that famous historian Lord Acton in the 19th century coined the epigraph, "All power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely," which you see illustrated today in world news all the time. It explains why celebrities today are polite on the surface but actually very aggressive if you annoy them in any way, because they actually believe they're better than you, because after all millions of other people agree with them, not with you. All that kind of inborn arrogance. Anyway. But also, a topic on the reserve list for topics for you is a famous paper from some decades ago based on interviewing British civil servants, which showed essentially that well-being went with where you were in the hierarchy. And that's against common sense, because on the whole, as you go up any organisation, you tend to work longer hours, your decisions have much more potential bad consequences. You might expect top people to be under stress, but actually, they're enjoying life. They're really enjoying life, and that's because fewer and fewer people can frustrate them. And I still remember my dad, who had a kind of civil service job. I can remember where he was number two for a long time, and at last his boss had to retire. And he was just markedly happier than that interfering man gone. No, no, we like being in control. Distortion of time. Now the top one, a clear expectation of goals and immediate feedback. I think, as you'll see, my take actually on the top of this is we're in flow and enjoying it when and only when at each stage of the task you immediately know what to do and you're interested in how it turns out. And what we don't like is either not knowing how to decide or not knowing what to do, or knowing all too well what to do and also that it will come out just as I expected, like washing the dishes, you know how it will come out. It's just not interesting to do, even though you know what to do. It's on that knife edge of not being oppressed by the difficulty of a decision, but still being interested in the actions and the outcome. Now, common but short examples that are flow in everything except perhaps being regarded as aligned with a person's best values would be talking and joking with other people. If you see people having a good time talking, they're not paying much attention to what's around them. They seem to be able to think of what to say next just like that. And so on. Of course, not all social intercourse is like that, but you know when you see people who are like that or having some minutes like that and how much they're enjoying it. Sex, can't speak for yours, but that's what Cheat Sent Me High says. Visiting galleries wouldn't be true of me, but it would be true of those who like to visit galleries. Lose yourself in the exhibits. There are lots of bodily activities that are like that, but also if you manage to get off in a good daydream, that'll be moments of flow. A lot of spectatorship, and so on. So those would be partial characterizations. Now, remembering for a moment a sort of framing question for positive psychology about in what does happiness reside, what's distinctive about Cheat Sent Me High's notion of flow, which doesn't cover the wider set that I'll be talking about a lot, is that for him it definitely concerned the engagement of that person's highest values. So for sculptors it was actually doing the sculpture, but for people with different different aims in life, it'll be associated with different things. And that's because one aspect of positive psychology as a whole is that goes by different names, but one idea, one word you see a lot is meaning. People seem to have higher well-being when they're able to see a lot of their activity as having a meaning they approve of. For instance, curing people when you're a doctor as opposed to doing plastic surgery, doctors who visibly save people's lives will have much greater satisfaction than those who are fiddling with their appearance most of the time. My brother-in-law is a farmer, and quite distressing for him, I think, in his career, and one reason he didn't stay in mainstream farming was at the time he went to agricultural college, people were still keen on the idea of feeding the hungry, and it's so clear in commercial farming now, you're mostly contributing to an excess that may be destroyed. The food, a lot of it doesn't go to people who need it. It's much less clear as a farmer that you're automatically and unthinkingly doing something worthwhile. And that's getting at this issue about meaningfulness, being in line with your own values is makes a difference to people's well-being. Now, most of what follows, although heavily influenced by many things I've read, is not Csikszentmihalyi's view exactly of what flow is, but it's to do with my own thinking and connections I make. So I tend to use as the centre of my definition of flow is this business about being where you aren't having any trouble making a decision because the next action comes to mind before you even have to ask yourself what to do. Also, I think flow has some connection to play because I think it's characterized by a greater or lesser extent of not knowing exactly what's going to happen, just having a confidence that that's the best thing you can do now, and you'll reassess the situation when that's done. So for instance, if I go for a new walk in a place I haven't been before, there's a pervasive pleasure from not knowing what's around the next corner. I may be a little obsessive, I may always have my Ordnance Survey map with me, but I can't read off the map exactly what it's going to look like. So round every corner and over every tiny hill is a new view, a new piece of information, and that's fundamentally to me more pleasurable than doing for the 10th time a walk I've done before, even in an outstanding place. So in other words, it's not just your actions which are typically engaged, but it's your perception. So if you think of video games, they're all about that. You partially can predict what's going to happen, but you're always looking for surprises and you're interested in the novelty. You could be serious or completely unserious about learning, but a bit of learning's going on. Now, when I start trying to put together the different things that are said and the different things, connections, flow suggest to me, there are actually several aspects or dimensions. So one is the balance between having too many and too few possibilities. In positive psychology, there's a topic called the burden of choice, which is based on experiments that show there are situations that are quite easy to contrive, where giving people more choice makes them less happy, contrary to naive consumer doctrine and naive expressions of what it is to be in a free country. Actually, we just, typical people become less happy with too much choice, but almost all of us become unhappy if we have no choice and we feel it's imposed from outside, as opposed to us knowing what to do next. Another dimensional issue here is, which isn't quite the same as choice, is about how many mental resources it requires. So typically, for a given level of arousal, of alertness, there's a level of challenge we like. And one of the things that's almost never discussed in this literature, but seems to me a big omission, is it's well known in other bits of psychology just how we vary in levels of alertness. And so if I catch you within half an hour when you're about to think of going to bed and give you some stressful thing to do, like you have now 30 minutes to submit before midnight your one and only chance of applying for postgrad place, you'll have trouble. With luck, your adrenaline glands will kick in and get your arousal up, but you may have real trouble. So if it's less challenging but something you'd normally like to do, like, I don't know, being polite to a relative you don't particularly want to talk to, you're likely to be caught out in impoliteness at the wrong time in the evening in a way that you wouldn't be in the middle of the day when you can devote more resources to it. So flow is also about whether you can manage a match between the mental resources you've got and whatever level of arousal you have. Another, which I've mentioned several times, is the match with your values. So I'm going to introduce briefly, say more at the end depending on time, about the burden of choice. So there's a key paper on this. And you can also find at least one, maybe more, past student wikis from this course about the burden of choice. The elaboration of this, introduced by Schwartz, is the idea that in general, although this doesn't, I think, occur to most people naturally, unless they've had a very particular education, is there are actually two kinds of strategy you can apply, at least two kinds of strategy you can apply to a choice. Maximizers are those who definitely want to make the optimal choice and stay unhappy if they're not sure they have. And those are the people who get made unhappy by too much choice. They're still trying to decide what's the best quality or what's the best value. But another kind of strategy, which I'm sure we all apply sometimes, but for some reason doesn't naturally occur to us to turn on in all situations, is technically called satisficing. And really that means good enough. So, I don't know, an example might be if you go to a restaurant, but really you're doing it for a discussion, which is important to you, perhaps an informal professional discussion, you probably won't care whether you order the very best dish for you on the menu, just something that won't actually make you gag in front of this important other person. It's just something that's good enough. So Schwartz is alerting us to the fact that there are two strategies you can find in people, and the burden of choice is people who fail to switch strategies when, from an analytic perspective, they probably should. And they're variations if you wanted to get into not what actual humans do so much as to what an idealized robot might do. So one variation is you estimate what the penalty for not getting the optimal is. And so you might be able to say, I can't tell which of these hi-fis is really better, but the penalty of getting the wrong one just isn't enough to justify the effort of prolonged testing. So in other words, many choices in the real world have a cost. Sometimes you can estimate in advance what the cost is, and then obviously it's not rational to spend more resources on making the optimal decision than you could save back by hanging out for the very best. So that's just a one-slide version of the burden of choice. Now going back to other potential dimensions here, this is the arousal dimension, sometimes called the Yerkes-Dodson law, but sometimes it's called something else. I would expect you to have heard of it probably in your year one psychology course, but I can't be quite sure what you should look it up in the index. But the classic graphs associated with it are like that. So the vertical axis is how well you do the task. So obviously, in some sense, you're performing better at the peak of the curve, and the horizontal axis is how aroused you are. Where that optimal peak is actually turns out to depend partly on the task. So classically, the heavy dark blue line corresponds to cognitive tasks. So if I'm asking you to do something that requires significant thinking, your peak performance is at a lower point on the arousal. In other words, if I get you in a real panic, you gradually stop being able to think at all, and that will impact cognitive tasks like which way to run. Whereas if it's just a matter of running for your life, the light blue is more like it, and you'll perform better with higher level of panics. Of course, if you run the wrong way, that... So that's relevant here, because if flow is a balance, then one of the balances is about whether the person's got a good match between their level of arousal for the task in hand. And I'll tell you one place I've noticed that, as it were, in my personal life, which is that if it's late in the evening and really I should go to bed, but I can't quite make the decision, and let's say an old Clint Eastwood movie comes on, it's amazing how it can keep my attention for hours. But if I've got a day off, tell myself I deserve the day off and I should do the most indulgent thing I can do, I have breakfast, I've got a full stomach, I'm totally alert, and then I turn to Clint Eastwood and I think, I can't be bothered to sit this, it's so trivial, and it actually will not do, and I have to find something more intellectually engaging. So normally, you see, people, including me, would talk about things being good or bad, my favourite or not, but actually, it's strongly influenced by whether the level of arousal is appropriate to that task. So the other way round is, I watch quite a lot of TV documentaries, but it's no good on the whole trying to watch them after the middle of the evening, because those soothing voices, of which David Attenborough's is only one, means I'll fall asleep even while telling myself this is interesting and I'm learning new stuff. And I'm not lying to myself about being interesting, it's just it doesn't bring the arousal at that time of night. Now this graph is about challenge versus skill. So the same person, but at different times in developing their expertise at a task, will find a task of different difficulties. And again, flow is about when there's a good balance between how challenging that task is for that person at that stage in their skill acquisition. And you see that to the top left of the graph is where it's just too challenging. You feel anxious, and you're probably going to worry in the burden of choice way because you don't know what to do next and you don't know how to choose. And down in the bottom right quadrant, it's too easy to choose and you're bored. Now, some of the literature talks about passive versus active tasks. I think, and it's clearly true that some tasks involve physical movement and some don't. It's actually maybe quite hard to define that really, because probably what matters about being active is whether your brain's engaged. And it's perfectly possible, although perhaps not very common, to be, say, watching the video of a documentary or lecture that engages you at the limit of what you can do. It's quite hard to find things like that, but it certainly can happen. And that, you've got your brain spinning, you know, say, just spoke a bit faster, you completely lose it, you're right on the edge, it's completely engaging. So I think the trouble with the passive versus active thing is that active probably really means having your brain engaged, and it's not necessarily good to take the easy definition of physical engagement. So painting, for instance, with an original painter does involve moving the hands around, but what's engaging the painter is what's original to them in this painting and whatever thought processes are underpinning that. So here I want to introduce a 3 or 4 way distinction about types of flow, and it's the third one, which is Csikszentmihalyi's. The first two are matters, I think, of pretty common experience. If you think about something you have done a lot, and let's say travelling to work or university on a route you've done many times, most people will sometimes do it and arrive at work and not able to remember anything about the journey there, and I would call that U-flow, that is, it satisfies other things about the definition of flow, but it's left no trace. Whereas C-flow, they would be absorbed. So if you drive a car, you could either and you're in plenty of time, you might well experience U-flow. If you're in a panic and try and drive faster, which would probably only be 10% faster, you would absolutely have your full mind engaged in it. You'd be taking risks, looking for differences. An outsider might, apart from the expression on your face, an outsider might be quite hard pushed to know that these were different for you, but you would be completely focused on that, not drifting off somewhere else. And yet, what I call unconscious you flow has in many ways the same as conscious flow, apart from the consciousness aspect, because especially if you think about driving or driving a car or walking, in all cases you're never going to do the same set of movements twice in a row. You might be following the same route in a street map, but people do not have a completely consistent stride length. They have to dodge different pedestrians or other traffic. It's full of variability each time, and in fact this is true even of someone walking with no one else around. David, I think his name's David Lee, did a study in the 1970s at University of Edinburgh, which is a psychology study, which is very amusing from a certain point of view. He took high-speed film of athletes practicing the long jump. So, as you probably know, the long jump, you start a long way away, you run as fast as you can, but how far you jump is measured from the baseline. So you mustn't step over the baseline, but you want to get as close as possible. And all the athletes believe, and all their coaches believe, that it's really important for the individual to pace out the distance carefully before, start the right number of paces away. When you analyse the film, you can see that each athlete has a characteristic stride length, which is consistent until they get to within about two paces, and then it's variable, and it's not the same from go to go. So it's quite obvious they're not replicating their steps, and their conscious theory of how they're doing it is utterly false. So their trainers. It just indicates, you see, that many of our actions are actually governed by feedback, and they work perfectly well. But it's not because we're robots who every step was programmed before the whole activity started. It's about adapting as we go along. So that's why U-flow fulfills many important conditions of flow, because you are using your perception as well as your action. Part of your mind is clearly processing that stuff, it's just not using the whole of your mind. So then, one distinction is whether and how much of your conscious mind resources are actually engaged in the task. An MC flow, Csikszentmihalyi's version of flow, adds to that the business about the importance, the top importance really, in the cases he studies, to the person of the activity. That is, it's the thing they most value in life. And I'm going to talk in a minute about a fourth alternative, which I've called metaflow, which is I'll talk about later, but the distinction really is that in trying to understand the widespread appeal of video games, an apparent paradox emerges. That is, video games are all about frustrating users. They're about having rules and not telling you what they are. And for some reason, huge numbers of us actually like that. It's impossible to understand that from a normal human-computer interaction where the frustrations are all negative. It's as if we like to learn. Now, when I say metaflow, I'm trying to refer to how you can have something that is clearly not flow because it's frequently disrupted at the obvious level, but it feels like flow to the person, and that's because, in my interpretation, it's because if we know we're learning from it, we're not bothered about frustration. We're doing actions to learn even more than we are to get an effect. So as long as they know what little test to do to learn the next stage, then they're going to feel they're in flow. And in a way, going for a walk in a strange place is like that. I don't know what's over the hill. Sometimes it will be disappointing, sometimes very rewarding, but I don't feel on the whole that I wasted time going to look. I took the best that I knew what I wanted to do to satisfy my next bit of curiosity, and it was satisfied. Whether it was satisfied big or small was part of the unknown, but I knew that in advance. So metaflow is a little different in that sense. Now, I want to point out another connection, which is that in the 1980s, when the field of human-computer interaction really got going, an important concept was direct manipulation, which was an attempt to describe what was so good about the interfaces you're now familiar with, for instance, Microsoft Word, to the things that had been common 10 years before, where users would be typing commands to do editing. Now, annoying as Word can be in some ways, it's absolutely got the main characteristics of direct manipulation. That is, you see in front of you the text you've written so far. You can change it character by character, and if you change it, the change instantly gets mirrored. You don't have to do it in any particular order. You can pick what you'll do next. You've got all that control. You've got that instant feedback, and you've got many things to do. And that's so much more agreeable to use, I think because it supports flow, than interfaces which don't have those characteristics. And many natural interfaces don't. So if you're, for instance, like to do a bit of woodworking, you make a cut too many and that's the whole thing ruined. There's no undo with most real physical objects. The virtual world is so superior from the point of view of human enjoyment in many ways, and that's one of the biggest about always knowing within wide limits how to undo something, because it allows you to explore, to not have to stop and think hard about what you're doing because the penalties are big. But there's another reason for this particular slide, which is that in human-computer interaction, there's an important distinction between that's to do with flow, which is the problem learning how to operate the software, or can you forget operating the software and focus on getting the work done? So the good experience is achieving flow where the user's able to focus on, say, writing their essay. They're thinking about the meaning and the words. They're not thinking about where's the edit command, what's the keyboard shortcut for undo, and all the rest of it. So there's two levels, and it's disruptive if you have to think about the means to the end, and it's good to the extent that it lets the user spend long periods of time where their head's entirely in the workspace of achieving what they want to do. Now, I may have said that, but I'll repeat it. I think probably, if you haven't had explicit lectures on this, our tendency is to assume that the more repetitive a task is, the more a person repeats exactly the same actions. And it's surprising to discover how untrue that is, as David Lee's example with long jumpers shows. This can be illustrated in a number of places, but one that might perhaps work for you is as you know, in word processors the left hand margin and indents are usually controlled by something they call a ruler, and they're little things you can move that will either move the left margin or move the indent. Now, very few people, if they don't have their software open in front of them, well, even if they do, very few people actually know which controls which. Almost everyone just re-experiments each time because they're so lazy they can't be bothered to know. Well, that's what an uninsightful person from outside would say. Now, I use that example because you've probably you've used Word a huge amount, and you've probably changed the left margins quite a bit it's a bit surprising that after, let's say, 10 or 20 exposures, you haven't learned the action. But I think the answer is that when the environment means there's such a small benefit from learning it by heart, you might as well relearn it. Actually, that's what humans do. And it is quite general. So, for instance, never mind about the elaborations, but I think this is quite a widespread but not much noticed feature, is that a lot of the way we memorize procedural actions is not, in fact, as a fixed sequence. It seems to be mostly encoded as a response to a perceptual input. That's true for walking, but that might be partly because our motor control isn't all that great on our legs. But I think it's much more wide than that. In fact, you can predict some kinds of human errors a bit in this way. And it's a different way of conceiving about the probable mental representation in memory of these things. There have been a few psychology theories that are really focused on whether skills could be, and learning of skills could be entirely described by compiling lots of condition action rules in the head. And why is this important in flow? Is because I think flow is typically about action of that kind. The sculptor chips a little bit off and looks at the result. It's those endless perception and action, not just action. Right, here are two tests. The first one might not work for visiting students, in which case you should go straight to exercise two. So the first one is without cheating by looking at your neighbours and with you all using your laptops to get a photograph up, is to make a sketch of the Boydor building. When I was a postdoc in San Diego, they sprung this on me. And this was after I'd been there for more than a year, and not only wasn't I clear about the number of floors, but I'd completely missed the fact the entrance was in fact not in the middle symmetrically, but off to one side. If that doesn't get you, can you list the commands on Word's edit menu, a menu you probably look at nearly every day and have done for years, but probably most people's memory is at best 10%, is my guess. Now, if you want to demonstrate to yourself exactly how many edit commands you do and don't use, you probably need to open that word processor yourself. Here's an out-of-date version of Word. But certainly, this is, in fact, although I got interested in it in more modern context, this is a very old demonstration. I can remember in 1962 a schoolmaster doing this on us using a post box, old-fashioned post box, which has all these things. And as eager young boys, we'd often posted a letter for our parents, and we knew all the bits, but we were really no good at remembering their relative positions. After all, you don't need to remember relative positions when you're using something. So I think the important lesson is that it's just not true that repeated exposure leads automatically to learning, and that's the main fact about learning. Actually, lots of things we never learn in spite of repeated exposure. And it seems to me a lot of research psychologists haven't understood this either. After all, would you hear all this stuff about all this overemphasis on special bits of the brain to recognize faces when you understood how little people bother to remember about things? After all, quite young children are often apparently unable to remember their teacher's face if it's outside the context of the school. And indeed, if you're an anxious parent with young children walking down a crowded shopping street in a Glasgow winter, the face is going to be absolutely no use in recognising your child. If they're not paying attention to you, you need to be worried, and they'll have their back to you. you have to remember what they're wearing and their height and things like that. It's, you know, remembering all the details actually is often not useful in a task either, because what's useful is the things that, well, J.J. Gibson would call it the invariants, the things that are true across context and lighting and so on. So it's probably functional in various ways for us not to clutter our mind with remembering details that aren't of demonstrated usefulness. So this is to re-emphasize that, contrary to what we might enthusiastically say and what a few careless bits of writing on flow seem to say, that strictly speaking, flow states are states without experienced emotion. It's also, in some sense, a state of the narrowest kind of consciousness. So for philosophers who naively write that consciousness is good and more consciousness is better, that's a bit of a blow for that careless thinking. I think it being a flow, being a state of no pre-planning, is probably important. And I think that's why we like it. That doesn't mean we can have it all the time, but I think that's one of the reasons it feels good. Provided it works, of course. Now, this is another of the dimensions. Hannah, are you in the room? Hannah? Has anyone in the room read any John Dewey? No. Out of fashion, educational writer. And I dug this out of Dewey and had a think about what it said about flow. Because yet again he cuts it from a different angle from other people. So he makes those four distinctions between foolery, play, engaging work and drudgery. So foolery is the word he chooses for, you know, a bored schoolboy shredding a bit of paper on the desk, that sort of thing. Play is rather more engaging play than they might do in the playground. Engaging work is what it says. Drudgery is his term for work that's completely not engaging. So the dimensions this is making us think about is enjoyment going up and down, but realism from left to right. I think that's the term Dewey used. Now, for me, perhaps, I would redefine the horizontal dimension as about learning versus doing, achieving. The thing Dewey's got there, which he calls realism, is actually about how well connected the task is or is not to the world of work. Now that's important educationally, of course, because children are just as sensitive as other people in society to whether what they're being asked to do is got anything to do with what society cares about. One of the perhaps very negative consequences for children in the last 200 years has been saving them from work has also meant putting them in a position where they're entirely useless and unvalued by society. Whereas if you were brought up 300 years ago on a farm, you'd be, by the age of 7, you'd be starting to participate in farm work, and it wouldn't matter if your parents were grumpy or not about it, you couldn't help knowing that when you herded the cows in, you were doing something useful that the grown-ups valued. They might be grumpy because you weren't doing it as well as you might, but there'd be no doubt about the meaningfulness of what you were doing. And in education, that's a big question about the limited extent to which you can keep students interested when there's not a visible connection between what they're learning to things they think are valuable outside education. So I think that's the that's why Dewey is interested in that bottom dimension. And that remains important in education today, but it might be a little more interesting to think about learning versus doing for the following reason. Excuse me. I'll talk about fun more in a second. The third point here in the previous diagram. So Csikszentmihalyi is also interested in how serious and valued an activity is as part of his definition of optimal flow. But I want to say a few words elaborating on that. So I believe it's although I still haven't come across anything that puts it like this in anything I've read so far, but I think it's pretty much universally true that every action a human takes actually has two consequences. One is the material consequences, so if I move that, I've moved a physical object. If I write an essay and publish it, there's something tangible going out. That's one consequence, and the one that's usually attended to from our actions. But actually, always, there's also a learning effect. If you've done something 100 times before, it might be a very small learning effect. If it's the first time you've done it, there'll be a big learning effect. So, now, why do I say that? There's an ancient study, may have dropped off the level one curriculum now, but in the 50s, I think it was, someone did a study of cigar rolling in Cuban factories for cigars. And it doesn't take long to roll a cigar, so with a bit of a longitudinal study, you can measure the performance of a woman doing this task over, say, 10,000 trials or something. And the interesting thing is, as you'd expect, they get better very quickly at first, and it gradually flattens off, but it never, ever stops. That's what the longitudinal study shows, that even though the increments of learning became tinier and tinier for a given number of extra trials, people seem to go on getting better ever so slightly all the time. So that's why I would say that every action of ours has both a learning outcome and a material outcome. Now, a corollary of that is that an intentional action, a purposeful action by someone, can therefore be done for one of two quite different reasons. It might be it's done because you want the material outcome, but you just learn as a side effect, or it might be because you want to learn and the material outcome is the side effect. And that's important for some of the cases you might want to think about in terms of flow. Because when I'm looking over the hill due to curiosity, what I want is the information. It's just the side effect that I have to walk some more and get a bit tireder. On the other hand, if I wanted my tea and I was looking for the tea room, I would only care about whether I was reaching it, and whether it was new or not would not be my intention in the action. So in trying to analyze things about flow, then have to keep an eye on the two kinds of effects and consequently the two kinds of goals. So in Dewey's graph, the left-hand side, it's clear it's about learning or curiosity. It's about seeing what happens. So one of the things about play is that you just do it to see what happens. With foolery, it's hardly enjoyable at all, and there's not much consequence, but nevertheless, if you're bored enough, you'll destroy a bit of paper or something. Much more engaging if you found a task where you'll learn something more substantial. Whereas on the right-hand side of that graph, it's about the material outcomes, and if they're valued, then they'll be, it's about their value in society. So this is important in video games. These numbers are now, as you can see, a few years out of date, but it's got to the point where it has to be regarded as likely to be a universal human. Whatever it is underlying video games is probably a universal thing. It's also very important economically. It's long. The global annual turnover in gross sales of video games, measured in dollars, is far greater than gross sales by Hollywood. The film industry is small compared to video games now. If you want to be rich and you've got a little musical talent, what you want to do is to get a little bit of your playing, or even better, your composition, adopted in a video game. Much more lucrative than getting it on the soundtrack of a film. Apparently. Of course, you won't be famous. You won't pull the women, but you'll be rich. It looks as if it gets at all ages, probably. So, video games is not a merely amusing sideshow for analysis. It's probably, we ought to be able to think about it as potentially having lessons for human activity, because it's quite, we all feel we have a rough intuitive idea about what's good about video games, but I haven't seen, although there's some very interesting books on that, I'm not convinced I can yet say or read exactly what the motivation is. But it seems to me, as I mentioned earlier really, it seems to be fundamentally about getting at people's love of learning, even when the learning is utterly useless. Because of course the point of games is they're artificial, and most of them are quite extraordinarily unrelated to the real world. How could we get interested in learning a bunch of rules, and even more, how to act successfully in line with those rules, when it has no application? Of course, there are a number of bitter lessons trying to make themselves heard here. Because I'm interested in education, of course I'm interested in the painful problem of to what extent students have any intrinsic motivation to learn. Most courses in educational institutions are really quite poor at addressing intrinsic motivations to learn. Video games seem to have absolutely no trouble. No trouble. And getting people to learn completely meaningless stuff and to pay for it, and to pay even more in hours than they do in money. Now, one of the features, and this is perhaps not a universal thing, it's a bit of a generalization that applies to quite a lot of the more successful designs, is, and I'm really relying on accounts from a postgrad I've got who's whole PhD to do with video games and learning, is that they tend to come with effectively the ability or the requirement to learn on several levels at once, and it's up to and users are seen switching their attention, their focus for a while from upping their learning on one level or another. So that's when I started thinking about the way in which a computer gamer is in flow, and since many of them exhibit to a huge degree most of the symptoms of flow, that is, forgetting time, endless absorption, preferring it to all other activities, lots of features seeming common. Does this fit? And I think it fits because the games support endless activity with feedback, but the goals, although that's not what the game itself says, the game would have you believe that, you know, scoring the points or moving to another level is a goal, which is true in one sense, but I think probably the real goal of a gamer is to get more expert at it. That's what they're trying to do, not least because when they succeed completely, they tend to abandon the game and find another. And that's a sign that the thing that was really driving them has now lost its grip. So I think probably video games really are about learning in that sense. That's the most profound kind of goal. And that when you see a gamer in flow, they're in flow in a learning rather than a doing task is probably the correct analysis to think about. And that's why I'm introducing it into this discussion. So, I've mentioned, let's say, six aspects or dimensions, and since I can't draw and you can't interpret six-dimensional graphics, we probably have to, you know, maybe fit two with any comfort onto a graph. This is a summary of them. And whereas enjoyment might be, as it were, the main dependent measure, the other five are all independent measures in the sense that they seem to affect how much enjoyment a given person gets out of a given situation. I'll include a few more slides on the burden of choice and then come back to wrapping up. I think what this means is that a consumer choice between, say, 20 different kinds of artisan jam or something you might hear, is likely to knock them out of flow because they're unable to have a maximizing procedure they can apply. Whereas if they were managed to convince themselves that satisfying is good enough, they might regard the same situation as one they could deal with in flow. This, although Schwartz makes this presents this in a way that fits right into positive psychology. In fact, his drawing on, and a few of you may choose to be interested in this, as ideas about rational human behavior and the situations in which humans don't seem to make choices rationally that are often published under economics or other areas. So certainly the term satisficing comes from Herb Simon and his interest in who has got a Nobel Prize for economics, has a psychology is interesting to economics only because humans fail to be rational and therefore they tend to defeat economic theories which assume rationality against the evidence. If you're interested in actual human behavior and you accept that choice can be a burden rather than a pleasure, then you can start thinking about how different individuals tend to address this in practice. So many of us actually spend some effort and even research on a choice once, and then we try and stay with that choice. I've not got up-to-date figures, but certainly a friend I had when I was young worked for a short time as a trainee manager in Unilever, which makes large numbers of soap, amounts of soap powder. As a trainee, he got to visit the research labs where enthusiastic chemists could show him detergents that worked 10 times better on various measures than anything in the shops. And so he naively asked why then Unilever wasn't selling them, to which the top answer was that at that time anyway, but perhaps still today, the single biggest predictor of which soap powder a person would buy is which soap powder their mother bought. And that's an illustration of that. But it matters in other ways. I once supervised a project for a student who was interested in nutrition labelling on food after the nutrition legislation, labelling legislation came in, and I naively sent her out to observe people in supermarkets to see if they read it. And only after a bit did it occur to me what a stupid idea that was, because just because someone doesn't look at the nutrition labelling when they buy a can doesn't mean they didn't consult it at an appropriate time and then remember their decision. So I think that's one way, one tactic you often see about how people make choices and stick to it. And of course, capitalism's continually undermining that strategy of investing in knowledge. In fact, I think it might be worth pointing out that our society as a whole is surprisingly blind to investment in learning. Why do I say that? Because you very seldom see a project for organisational change of some kind which measures and gives a financial value to the learning capital that all its employees have. They introduce something new as if learning a new system had no cost. Actually, of course it has a cost, and that cost isn't for trainers, since most people don't learn much from training courses, learn a lot more from practice. So we have huge investments in knowledge, and change is continually undermining that. In my unresearched and rather hostile view of supermarkets, is the continual introduction of brands is done because it gets people to experiment with new things and pay for the experiment themselves. When you think about that, that's an enormous and very wasteful cost on consumers, especially as a lot of new things aren't new at all, it's just the label that's new. So it's a blindness. I think if our society all the time talked about the learning capital and what actions threatened to destroy that and whether that was justified and who should pay for that destruction, things might be quite different. Obviously another remedy is people can adopt is satisfying and not obsessing about the better thing. Right, so that's a slight expansion on burden of choice. Things I'd like you to do for next time. I hope to include a bit on strengths, which is another traditional topic in positive psychology. And the best thing to do is to go to that website. I've got that on the webpage already, a link. You can do their questionnaire for free, and you should get a little report on what, on the basis of your answers, your strengths are supposed to be. And this will vary. I mean, this is like personality. You'd expect in any random sample to have a big range of different strengths in a given audience, and we'll discuss that. I'd like you to type up a note on conclusions from Wiki Critiquing and post it in your group's forum. I'd like you, obviously, to get cracking on your coursework. You don't need to do mindfulness this week, but it would be good if you'd read something on mindfulness by the last session when we've got Rowan coming to talk. And that's all I had to say.